And I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2404.
I guess that'd be my cue, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2404 modifies the definition of employment relations in certain public collective bargaining to include staffing levels and safety issues that have a potential impact on the job safety and the workload of the employees.
Thank you. And just to start off, I want everybody to get everything they want on the record. I'm not going to keep a time clock on anybody, but if you can not read your testimony. If you have written testimony, submit it and then summarize it as completely as you can. And I'm going to stay here until 6 o'clock. Hopefully we'll be done. I'm not holding the committee here till 6 o'clock. If you all have things to get going, I understand. I just want to make sure everybody gets as much on their record as they possibly can. And we're hearing the House version today. The Senate version is identical. There's a possibility that the Senate version may get over here before this gets over there for whatever reason. I just want to give you a heads up on that. But we're going to hear the complete everybody's testimony today, and then we may have an abbreviated hearing on the Senate version. It'll be the same language. If there's any changes, then clearly we'll have another full hearing on that too. So I just want to let everybody know what's going on. And once again, please, I beg you, be as concise as you possibly can be. Get everything you need on the record. I'm asking you not to read your testimony. If it's lengthy, just summarize it and submit your written testimony to Kristen over here. And I'm going to hear the proponents of the bill, and then I'm going to listen to the opponents of the bill. And then at the end, I'm going to let the proponent come up and respond to any opposition. And that's just how it's going to go. And first, I'm going to call Bob Livingston and Tom Chamberlain, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I'm a firefighter here in Salem, but I'm also the legislative director for the Oregon State Firefighters, and my comments today will be on behalf of that organization and the career firefighters of Oregon. House Bill 2404 is a common-sense, straightforward bill that simply allows your firefighters, police officers, and other non-strikeable groups to discuss safety and staffing levels that have a potential impact on on-the-job safety. A right currently afforded to many other hardworking Oregonians, such as iron workers, nurses, and electricians. Unfortunately, many people and groups either do not understand public employees' collective bargaining laws or simply do not want employees to discuss these issues during bargaining. The current problem that we face now is that under the current law, in order to discuss safety issues, employees must be able to show that the safety issue has a, and I quote, direct and substantial effect on the job safety of public employees. The reason for this is that the Employment Relations Board has made it clear that under the current statutory scheme, and I quote, when the subject of a proposal concerns safety, staffing, or workload, we are required to determine its effect in order to determine its bargaining status.
Bob, hang on a second. I want to remind you all to shut your electronic devices off, please. I'm check mine, too.
End quote, Mr. Chair. Determining the effect is like waiting for an officer to get shot. It can only be proven as an afterthought. To date, it is my understanding that since 1995, the Employment Relations Board has never ruled in favor of employees on whether or not safety or certain staffing levels are mandatory subjects of bargaining. Prior to 1995, issues surrounding on-the-job safety required a discussion. House Bill 2404 corrects this inequity. Ironically, of all the workforces in Oregon, and certainly while I'm biased, you would think that your virtue of your public safety officers would have the ability to discuss safety issues of all things. Many opponents of this bill will argue several factors. I'd like to just briefly discuss four. One, we've heard arguments that this bill will be too costly. Two, this takes away local control from elected officials. Three, They will argue that every issue can be regarded as having a potential impact on safety and staffing. And four, I think you will hear arguments that safety is paramount to every public safety executive. And OROSHA already enforces safety guidelines, and so why do you need this bill? To that, with respect to too costly, I think the first thing to remember is that we do have experience with this issue being able to be bargained. Prior to 1995, your public safety officers were able to discuss these issues. And I think historically, if you looked back, you will not find any anecdotal evidence that states that this is going to drive up cost. In addition, since that time, current law provides two significant and extremely effective tools that are available to employers. The first, last final best offer. The second, ability to pay. Last final best offer simply means, and if I could, let me back up 1 second. Most of the time, I would say, and I could get you this figure, but I would say roughly 95%, or at least between 90 and 95% of the times, people that are in this room, many of them in this room, are able to reach agreements with their employers at the bargaining table, meaning that we really never even get to an interest arbitrator in interest arbitration. And so in those times that we do, some of the laws have changed, and one of the big tools that's been effective for employers and employees alike is this issue called last final best offer, which simply means that if you're not able to reach an agreement, an arbitrator is forced to either choose one package or the other package. They can't mix and match. They can't pick and choose. They can't change the offers. It's really, if you will, it's high-stake pokers. It's an all-in mission. An additional factor that we believe gives employers additional protections is one of the criteria that is available. And if you look and if you spend the time over the past several years, ability to pay is a huge consideration that an arbitrator looks at. And in the statutes, this is already in the statutory schemes, I'll quote this criteria. Quote, the reasonable financial ability of the unit of government to meet the cost of the proposed contract, giving due consideration and weight to other services provided by and other priorities of the unit of government as determined by the governing body. A reasonable operating reserve against future contingencies, which does not include funds in contemplation of settlement of the labor dispute, shall not be considered as available towards settlement. And I think if you were to take the time and look at some of these decisions, clearly one of the most paramount things that they look at is the ability to pay. And even though they have been about 50%, the reason they've been 50% is the huge deference that arbitrators give towards the ability to pay. So I think there are safeguards that are still in legislation now that this bill does not contemplate taking away. The second issue that I think concerns some folks is that this bill takes away local control from elected officials. If an employer feels that increased staffing in public safety departments or better safety equipment and practices will negatively impact other services that the government seeks to offer, the employer is free to make those arguments at the bargaining table and to make those arguments to an interest arbitrator. Conversely, a bullet fired at a Pendleton police officer or a Portland police officer will not discriminate. A Medford firefighter trapped in a burning building without radio communications, similar to a firefighter trapped in a burning building here in Salem without radio communications, will not discriminate. This bill does, however, afford for the two parties to sit down at the local level and discuss ways to solve these issues, or at a minimum, at least to address them. And so we believe that this bill allows for greater local control rather than less local control. Conversely, an alternative that you could contemplate as a legislative body, and I think members of this body have contemplated in the past, is that we certainly could establish safety, staffing, and training standards and put those in the statutes for all public safety officers. Clearly, I think that you will get no arguments that there are national standards out there that both police chiefs, firefighters, and police officers have all, in the larger group, agreed to, whether it's NFPA standards, whether it's police officers per thousand, appropriate ways to handle an arrest, so on and so forth. Clearly, there's much documentation out there that allows for national standards. Problem with that is that truly would take away local control. This bill retains that. An additional issue that I think you will hear today is that every issue can be regarded as having a potential impact on safety and staffing. Keep in mind, this proposal requires only that employers be open to discussing safety and staffing issues at the bargaining table. It does not impose the union's will. Not all staffing or safety-related issues need to be discussed. Again, in current legislation, current statutes, issues that are de minimis or insubstantial are not considered mandatory subjects of bargaining. In the past, employers have argued, amongst other things, that unions will, under the guise of safety, bring issues like the ability to wear stocking caps, Trillium night sight on handguns to the bargaining table. Not only would this more than likely be considered to be a de minimis subject, even if it wasn't, there's a specific timetable that requires that in a 150-day period, negotiations have to end, another 14-day cooling-off period. And in addition, even if we were to get over the hurdle of those issues that are de minimis and insubstantial, once again, you face the last final best offer and the ability to pay argument. So again, there's safeguards built into the current statutes that are going to mitigate any concerns with that. Finally, like their private sector colleagues, public managers can just say no. Collective bargaining does not require concessions on any particular item. This bill simply just would require a conversation. Finally, safety is paramount to every public safety executive, and OROSHA also enforces safety, and therefore this bill is unnecessary. Almost every mission statement or every public safety executive will argue that safety of employees is a top priority, and that OROSHA is also there to enforce safety rules, making this bill unnecessary. If this is truly the case, and if employers and executives agree with this philosophy, what is the harm in allowing for an open and free discussion regarding safety and staffing levels that have an impact on on-the-job safety? Employers who are truly operating in this fashion should not be fearful of this modest readjustment in our current bargaining laws, but rather embrace the concept. To simply hide under the guise of this philosophy or OSHA, I've practiced that and I never can get it right, is not only insulting to the men and women who risk their lives every day to protect others, it simply does not serve the public interest. Mr. Chair, if I could, in my closing remarks, I think it is worth noting that 2 days from now, on January 31st, in the year 1973, in this House Labor Committee, a task force formed by then Governor Tom McCall introduced a draft bill that, with the help from then counsel to the committee, Ted Kulongoski, would become the framework for what is now known as Oregon's Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act. As part of this landmark legislation, the legislative body declared in part that, and I quote, experience in private and public employment has also proved that protection by law of the right of employees to organize and negotiate collectively safeguards employees and public from injury, impairment, and interruptions of necessary services, and removes certain recognized sources of strife and unrest by encouraging practices fundamental to the peaceful adjustments of disputes arising out of differences as to wages, hours, terms, and other working conditions, and by establishing greater equality of bargaining power between public employers and public employees, end quote. Since that time, we have seen many challenges and changes in our communities and our country. Unfortunately, not all of them pleasant and many of them indelible. And as I look around today and I see many of my colleagues, for many in this room, not a day goes by without remembering the day America changed forever, where 343 firefighters gave the supreme sacrifice on 9/11 as World Trade Center towers came crashing down. Whether it is another terrorist attack, a natural disaster such as Hurricane Katrina, or the day-to-day emergency service call your firefighters and police officers respond to, one thing is for certain. The job of your public safety officers will continue to be challenging and dangerous. This bill cannot solve or prevent all of the challenges faced by today's firefighters, police officers, and other public safety officers, but it can restore a right that this institution once recognized, that right of employees to discuss safety and staffing levels that have an impact on the job safety. Every day, firefighters, police officers, and other colleagues of mine risk their lives to save others. We simply ask for a conversation on safety and staffing levels and hope that you would support House Bill 2404. And with that, Mr. Chair, if it would indulge you, I would like to allow Mr. Chamberlain to make some comments and then be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Tom?
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, I'm Tom Chamberlain, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I also was a firefighter for 27 years with the city of Portland. And it's tough to follow Bob. He's given you pretty much all the facts and figures. I think what I bring to this discussion is a historical perspective, because I was here in 1995. I was here when they changed the collective bargaining law. And part of what they were trying to do, their goal, was to bring the parties closer to the table or closer to an agreement. And that's what final best offer does. It makes each party become realistic in what that final best offer is, the offer that they take to the arbitrator. So what would happen if firefighters had the right to negotiate safety and staffing? Well, if they're going to arbitration, they'd have to make a decision. You want to maintain your health benefits and get a pay raise? Or do you want one or two more firefighters on a piece of apparatus? Do you want the new safety equipment, or are you willing to give up a pay raise or have a reduction in health care? Because final best arbitration, you only take one, perhaps two, financial proposals to the arbitrator's table. That's what it's designed to do. So the folks that are going to come forward today to say is they're going to upset the apple cart if we get this, it's just not true. Other point I'd like to make, Bob spoke to the 9/11 tragedy. And we all know that part of the problem with New York on September 11th was communications. Firefighters should have the right to talk about communications with their employer. Perhaps we could divert a catastrophe like we had in New York if we were able to talk about communications, safety equipment, and staffing. They didn't in New York. They didn't have the up-to-date safety equipment that would have allowed agencies to speak to each other, firefighters to police. Even the firefighters in the building couldn't converse with the firefighters outside the building. This is an important issue. It's about safety. It's about breadwinners for working families in this state. This is very important, and I encourage you to support this legislation.
Thank you. And we're going to have a long conversation in this building about being able to communicate with one another, if you've been reading the papers lately. Anybody have any questions for these gentlemen? All righty then. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My pleasure. I'd like to call Brian DeLashmit and Randy Ritterbush. I hope I got that right, Randy, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian DeLashmit. I'm a lobbyist. I represent a number of groups, the Oregon Council of Police Association, which is the line officers that do service to local jurisdictions, both municipal and county governments in the state. I represent the Oregon State Police Officers Association, which you would recognize as the state troopers in the state. Represent the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, those hardworking parole and probation officers that have to go out every day and monitor those folks that have gone through the system and are back on the streets. And I represent the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, which represents four institutions in the state, including the State Pen and OCI and Mill Creek in this vicinity. I, too, find it very difficult to follow Bob Livingston. Bob and I have been working together on these and other issues for a long time, and Bob's fire and passion comes from having to live the life of a firefighter and know that these issues continue to come up, that he needs to be aware of not only his own safety, but the safety of his brethren and the public. And so I'll start my comments by saying much of what I was planning on saying are exactly the comments that Bob made. But let me try and cut through and make some very specific points, and I won't go through my entire testimony. Obviously, you've heard about the reality versus, I think, somewhat fictitious arguments about ability to pay. It just isn't true. If you really truly look at the statute, the arbitrator, if it goes to arbitration, has to make those judgments about the employer's ability to pay and also provide other services. You will hear discussion. We've heard it. We've seen letters that have come in the past that say, well, they're going to ask, a police is going to ask for two police officers in every car. Now, let's get real. Let's get down to it. We didn't have two police officers in every car before 1995. When we change the system, we won't have two police officers in every car after this. We don't have enough state troopers to have one state trooper on the road right now in most jurisdictions. So let's talk facts to facts. The other thing that I'd like to kind of echo that Bob talked a little bit about, but let me expand. When this issue kind of started really bubbling a couple of sessions ago, there was a conscious decision to go this direction rather than the entirely different direction, which is a statewide standards. The response, and Bob talked about it, was, well, OSHA can take care of this. Well, OSHA can only take care of this if you have a statewide standard for every type of discipline. And you say, it doesn't matter whether you are Riddle, you're Kaiser, you're Portland, you're Eugene, or you're Salem. You're all going to fit the exact same standard. We made a very conscious effort back a couple of sessions ago to say what gives the maximum flexibility to a system that has to recognize the differences in different communities. And we said, well, there's nothing better than an employer in a local jurisdiction and the employee in a local jurisdiction sitting down and saying what is right for that jurisdiction. And that's why we decided to go this particular path and go back to this balancing act at the local level rather than the statewide standards. As Bob's indicated, there are standards that could be adopted, ratios, types of vests, you know, the whole litany of things. But we chose intentionally not to do that. So this argument that it's going to bankrupt the local folks and it's going to force our will upon them is not an accurate reflection of what we're attempting to do. We're attempting to say, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, please, you have the discussion. And if you can't come to a resolution, then it would go to an arbiter. An arbiter looking at the statute has to weigh a whole number of factors, including the ability to pay. That's simply what we're trying to do here. Let me talk a little bit about some specific issues. Everybody says, well, give us examples for public safety officers or police officers. Well, let me talk a little bit about corrections first. You know, I don't know how many of you have ever gone to the state pen or any of the other facilities. I wouldn't work there. I don't know of any of you.
Oh, you meant to visit. I got it.
Yeah.
No.
Vice Chair. I was stunned. Senator Courtney, then Representative Courtney, actually spent, a night in a lockup at the state pen, I believe it was. It may have been OCI some years ago, and finally called and was released early. He got an early release. He must not have been a bad enough offender. But the reality is that in these facilities, especially like the state pen, this facility is so old, so decrepit, that we not only need to talk about the safety of the officers, we need to talk about the safety of everybody in those facilities. And the ability for an officer who is placed in a particular setting when they have little or no backup just absolutely astounds me. And yet we have a statute on the books that says they can't bring it up. You can't talk about your safety. At one of the other facilities, the Mill Creek facility, I was listening earlier to one of the officers talking about, I believe his numbers were, they have a dorm. And they have one person on staff for that dorm, one correctional officer on staff for that dorm, and they have more than 100 offenders on that dorm. They cannot even discuss the safety issues or safety concerns they have about how unsafe that puts them as far as a position. You have breakouts of violence. We've had them in facilities. Officers, their duty is not only, obviously, to maintain control, but also protect those inmates that are in there. they attempt to do that. They break up those things. They put themselves in the way on personal harm to do what they're supposed to do. And they need to have the ability to talk about safety. Let's talk about parole and probation just for a minute. I don't know if any of you have gone out with a parole and probation officer, but we are letting folks out in the communities that years ago would have been behind lock and key for a long period of time. Predatory sex offenders, a variety of folks that are very violent folks, with the overwhelming number of meth addicts we have, the drugs that are going on. These folks go out and they have to enter a residence by themselves with little or no backup, knowing that the backup may be as much as 45 minutes to an hour away. And you're telling us, based upon the current statute, that they have no ability to have a discussion about their own safety with their employer. It blows me away. Let's talk briefly about other types of jobs that have the ability to talk about safety. Bob touched on a couple of those. Well, as you all well know, I work also on a contract with the Oregon Nurses Association. Several sessions ago, and two sessions in a row, the House and Senate passed House Bill 2800. It was a banner piece of legislation that really did two things. One, it says a nurse in a hospital setting will have the ability to sit down with their employer and talk about staffing. It passed overwhelmingly. Now, why did we do that? We did it because it was the right thing to do, and there should be that interaction between the employer and the employee over patient safety. And that's what they were really talking about with that. Well, in this, we're talking about the exact same parallel issue. So if it's right for nurses, it's right for steel workers, it's right for all the other appointment settings, why don't public safety officers have the ability to do this? With that, I'll close. The types of things we're talking about for police officers, in many cases I've heard examples of communications. That's the one that comes up probably most. It could be a matter of vests that need to be rotated out because they've outlived their life expectancy. It could be a type of vehicle. I don't know if you followed at all the Crown Victoria, which is historically the Crown Vicks or the police vehicles. Some evidence that the Crown Vicks have a tendency when hit rear end for the gas tank to rupture and an explosion to occur. There is a retrofit for that. The ability for jurisdiction and the officers that are concerned about that type of safety issue is what we're talking about. There's some evidence historically about a particular type of service weapon, a Glock, a certain model of Glock, that in fact misfires and the bullet actually explodes in the chamber and causes damage to the person that's firing that weapon. Those are the kinds of things we're really talking about here. With that, I'll close, and I'm after my colleague speaks, I'm willing to answer any questions. But I, too, speak with passion.
Hi. Members of the committee, Randy Ritterbush. I'm the corrections coordinator for AFSCME, which means I have been bargaining the corrections contracts for the last 6 or 7 years for the other 11 units that he does not. And I won't be near as eloquent as the rest of them have. I agree with everything they've said about the bargaining process, and they, of course, were going to say a lot of the same things I was. But I want to take a little different approach, and I want to talk about what's happening today and why it's broken. Right now, safety is a permissive subject of bargaining. And the way bargaining works with Interest ARB, we just can't take that. We just can't talk about it. The employer has no obligation to discuss anything. And like my colleague, it's appalling to think that I'm working on a yard and an inmate comes up and picks up a free weight and beats me half to death that I can't go to the bargaining table and talk to my employer about it. As you know, or you may or may not know, we had to come back after the blood was spilled to get the free weights removed from the institutions. We had to come back after people get stabbed to get vests approved. It's always more costly to come back afterwards and to fix the problem. If we are able to sit down at the bargaining table and at least have an intelligent conversation about safety, and as my colleagues before me have talked about. Bargaining is a give-and-take situation. I can't go in and say I want 300 officers more in the institutions and expect to get a wage increase, expect to get the other things that we need to make our institutions safe, that our members need to feed their families and to have health insurance. It's a balancing act. None of us could go in there and demand that the employer changes the way they do their business. Is what we want to do is for them to listen in earnest and to have some responsibility to the people that are putting their lives on the line for the state of Oregon. Currently, the Department of Corrections is more than willing to talk to us. We have major changes in our SEG rules going for some incentives right now, and it's loosening up the segregation. It's not the old hole that you would think about, that the inmate that acts up and he goes to the segregation unit and he doesn't have any privileges, they don't get mail, all that's gone. Matter of fact, the first thing that happens when you go to SEG now is you get two envelopes, so they make sure you can write your people and tell them what's happened to you. I recently had an officer assaulted. The inmate got 7 days in SAG. That's it. Right now last week we had an incident at EOCI where the segregation inmates decided that they were going to cause problems, and they started throwing feces and urine and clogging toilets. We had 6 inches of water on the floors. The inmates play the game. They break the lights. They rattle the things. They break windows. They throw food at the officers. And as soon as the officers gear up for a cell extraction, the inmate backs off and says, "Oh, no. I'm okay. Leave me alone. I'll go with you." We take the inmate away. They clean the cell up. The inmate goes back 3 hours later. Now they start giving him his privileges back and his property back. This went on for a week. The inmates played a game with the safety of the officers. It's unacceptable, and we have no way to talk to the department about these policies and these procedures that are putting our staff at risk. And I've got an officer right now that was recently, the cocktail was thrown on them, and that is the cocktail of feces and urine. Well, the inmate refuses to get a blood test, so we don't know if he's positive. So the officer has to drink the cocktail. And could you imagine wondering if you have hepatitis B?
A different cocktail, not the cocktail I was thrown up.
Oh, my God.
The prophylactic. Let's get clarification there.
But could you imagine going home to your family and not being able to touch your children or to give your husband a kiss or your wife a kiss because you don't know if you have a disease? And this goes on for days and weeks. But we don't have the right to go to the bargaining table and to talk about what our folks are going through. I, too, find it appalling. And I represent parole and probation officers, and I recently went on a ride-along, and I'll tell you what, I worked in a prison for 10 years. I'd rather be in a prison. That's scary out there. And to think that my parole officers don't have a right to talk about a vest to protect themselves or body alarms in case that they're on the ground and there's no way to respond or to work close with the police. Again, I urge you to seriously consider this. We're not going to break any cities. We're not going to break any counties. And we're not looking to tell people how to run the institutions. Instead, we're trying to partner with them and to let the people that are actually doing the job speak up and participate in their own safety.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I guess anecdotally, I'm wondering if, according to Bob Livingston's testimony, under current law, you are allowed to talk about, quote, direct and substantial effect on the job safety of public employees. Certainly, wouldn't feces throwing on a regular basis qualify under that as something you could discuss? I mean, just theoretically.
Yeah. No.
They wouldn't notice that feces were being thrown substantially in your workplace. I guess I think that might be sort of hyperbole. And if you have statistics that convince me, and this is the thrust of my question, Mr. DeLashmit, I'd like to see, and maybe further testifiers will come forward with statistics on safety issues and their progression and less anecdotal. So I'm rather than engage you, we've got a long ways, and I don't want to engage you. I'm long on anecdotes and short on statistics so far.
All right. Can we respond just to you briefly?
If you would like to,
yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, actually, let me respond in a couple of ways. One is that after the fact, what you're really talking about, blood and feces, is an after the fact piece. What we're really talking about here is the next occurrence of that, some way to talk about safety and how do we stop that from happening. It's the same way as a police officer being assaulted or not having a communications device. It's that, you know, that immediate or substantial piece is a barrier to, and the way that Herb has interpreted it is basically imminent and immediate, which means it's an after-the-fact standard. It says the occurrence actually has to have happened, and then you can prove, yeah, it has a substantial and direct impact on the safety of the employee. Well, that's an after-the-fact standard, and we want to be able to discuss the history of those things, take in consideration that this has already occurred. We want in the future be able to talk about that and other issues related to safety. So it's, do you do a preventative based upon past history, or do you wait for somebody to get shot, something to actually occur, and then respond to it? And does that meet that standard? And we're not sure in some cases whether we can even meet the standard after something's happened.
Anything else?
Thank you for your
time. All right, thank you, guys. I'm going to call Tyler Bricky, Dennis Casewell, and Robert Kennedy, please.
Good afternoon. I'm Dennis Caswell, local president 3361. I worked for the Department of Corrections for 15 years, and I come from a facility that Mr. Rudovich was just talking about. I've spent lots of time in the segregation unit that he just referenced, and I can tell you that that is not something that is unusual to us. The inmates don't have a lot of deterrent not to throw feces in urine, and it unfortunately happens all the time. Prior to that, a few days before that, we had an officer attacked in the chow hall. That was, his throat was cut and his face was slashed by an inmate that had just got out of IMU, which is an intensive management unit here in Salem. He hadn't been at EOCI for more than 4 hours. The first thing he did was go to the chow hall and go after this officer they didn't even know. This guy had a life sentence. He's never going to get out of prison. He's 23 years old. He's got absolutely nothing to lose. We can take him to segregation, which we have already done in the past. He's been in and out his entire time in our facilities, and leave him there as long as our programming will allow, which can be as short as 10 months. He gets back out, and he does it again. And he's done this several times. So we need some deterrent in the Oregon Department of Corrections to get this stopped, because we're not there for them to destroy our lives. And that's exactly is what has happened to some of our brothers and sisters. They can't go back to work. We'll go on to a housing unit, and there will be myself and up to 90 inmates.
Go ahead.
All right. Now I lost my train of thought.
I apologize. Hold up. I'll be right back. Go ahead.
Okay. So what we need is some help, some deterrent. And I'm here to talk about the situation that we have as far as asking for help through our employer, which we don't have the right to do. We can request, and they can decide if they're going to do that or not, but that's as far as it goes. We also have two large rec yards at EOCI that oftentimes will have 500 and 600 inmates at a time with no more than 3 to 4 to 5 staff. We have one tower on each side, and it's a portable tower. I spent 3 years in the military, and the first thing they taught me was how to shoot. And if I'm going to shoot, I have to have a stable platform to shoot from. Our towers go up, and they come down. Some of our staff are very large. As they try and get a sight picture, the last 2 to 3 years in a row, we've had to fire shots onto our yard to stop major disturbances. Fortunately, we haven't had to shoot anybody. But the inmates now rely on a warning shot. If the wind's blowing, if he's a big guy, and he leans forward to get a sight picture, the tower rocks. If the wind blows, the tower moves a little bit more. And now we expect this officer to take a shot onto the yard to stop a major disturbance. With the gang violence that we have, it is not uncommon. Every summer, we expect something like this to happen. And I'm here to tell you that one of these summers, somebody's going to get shot. It might be one of us on the yard, because he may be aiming for an inmate, and the wind blows, or the tower rocks, and he doesn't hit an inmate. Or he hits an innocent inmate, or there's a ricochet into the community of Pendleton, because EOCI is within the city limits. So all I can do is ask, which I've done three times, to get a fixed tower at EOCI, and we still have the portable towers, and they've been there for 6 or 7 years. We can't get any action on that at all. So we need your help to be able to fix some of these things and be proactive, not reactive. Because when we're reactive, somebody's already been hurt, maybe in the hospital, maybe dead. That's what we live with every day. Now, there are a few things that we have been able to fix, but it's taken years to do it. For instance, one of our large units at EOCI, there's 180 inmates and there's two staff. Each guy has 90 on each floor, and all he has is a radio to call for help. The bar box, which is what you open all the doors, it, when you operate it, your back is to 90 inmates as they file out of the day room and down the tier into their cell. So we stand there, face this direction while everybody walks behind us down to their cell, and we pop their doors. This is a medium facility. We have murderers, rapists, child molesters, everybody there that you would have at OSP other than death row. And we have our back to all of these guys as they file through. For 15 years, we asked for them to change that so we can move the bar box, so we could monitor the day room and monitor the tier as we ran major line movements, because you'll run a major line movement at least every hour. And we didn't get any action on this until finally we got a new superintendent in that was proactive. She listened to what we had to say, and they installed those bar boxes. Fortunately, before anybody was hurt seriously. Short to the point.
Yeah. Nice to go next. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, my name is Robert Kennedy. I am president of ASME Local 974 at Two Rivers Correctional Institution. And I'm in support of House Bill 2404 for this one reason and one reason alone. We need the ability to sit down with our managers in order to talk about safety issues. Specific occurrences that happen throughout the state are mostly typical of the facility that I currently work at. Right now I have 53 represented members who do not have the ability to go on vacation. And the reason they don't have the ability to go on vacation is because of funding. Management claims it's a funding issue. We understand that. We sit down and we try to work with them on that issue. We work very hard with them on that. But what they clearly don't understand is the risks that it takes our employees at. Once we get into a position where we are not staffed enough in order to allow individuals to go on vacation, those individuals that are there will be overworked. We work mandatory overtime. We work very long hours. Within the past 12 months, we have had two occurrences at TRCI where our staff members have been forced into 16-hour shifts, have gotten inside of their vehicles, and on the way home have fallen asleep at the wheel and totaled their vehicles. This union is currently trying to purchase hotel rooms for these individuals because our managers are not required to sit down and talk to us about this individual safety issue that's being created. This is one of the reasons why I wanted to sit and that I highly encourage that you folks approve this House bill. It would give us the ability to sit down with our folks and to talk to them. We run into many, many different situations out there that are very dangerous. And by the way, Mr. Ritterbush indicated an individual that was assaulted and the inmate only received 7 days. 6 months ago, I was the individual that was assaulted. Inmate Bergstead received 7 days inside of DSU as a result of his crime. My problem with that is when I approach my managers and have an issue with this, they don't have to sit down and discuss the issue with me. Even though inmate Bergstead is currently facing further felony counts for the assault that he incurred upon me, my manager still will not sit down and talk to me about why. I think that it's wrong that an inmate only has to spend 7 days in a lockup and then turn around and get released again, even though we can add felony charges onto his crime. So, I highly encourage you folks pass this bill, and with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Brickey.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tyler Bricky. I'm the vice president of AFSCME Local 3361. I'm here to represent the members of 3361 at Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution. I'm here speaking in favor of House Bill 2404. I'm a colleague of Sergeant Dennis Caswell, and as Mr. Ritterbush had explained about the disciplinary segregation unit the past 7 days, I was there. I was one of the sergeants in there for 7 days. Feces water, urine water, 6 inches deep on the tier, in the cell, broken glass being thrown at officers, not knowing what's going to be in the cell if you do have to go in the cell to extract this inmate. But yet, when it comes to bargaining, we can't bargain this with the state. I feel it's very, very unreasonable. You know, we should be able to sit down together as a local union or a Council 75 and sit down with the state and come to a mutual agreement so we can get it bargained into our contract. Like Sergeant Caswell said, let's be proactive, not reactive. If you're proactive, if I'm going to go down in the streets of Baghdad, I'm going to make sure my M16 is clean. I'm going to make sure I have my body armor on, my helmet. I'm being proactive because I'm protecting myself, protecting my buddies. That's why I encourage you to pass this. We'd be able to sit down, like I said, with the state at the bargaining table and implement this into our contract, making the institution safer, not only for the staff members, but for the inmates. And that's about all I have to say.
Well, thank you, sir. I wish I was hearing whether or not those people in Baghdad are safe or not, but that's a different subject. Any questions for these gentlemen? Alrighty then. Thank you very much. I'd like to call Randall Davis and Jason Jason, come on up. Thanks.
Chairman and committee members, my name is Jason Bratzolas.
I didn't hear your last name.
Bratzolas.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm the president of the local 415 for the Oregon Youth Authority. And I just want to come and speak on behalf. I want to provide Committee Member Berger with some statistics on. I know a lot of the guys have talked about some anecdotal information. I want to talk about specifically communications, radio communications. I have an institution. We house approximately 180 offenders here in Salem and juveniles between the ages of 12 and 25. When I first began my career back in 99, there was a different type of clientele. And the clientele today that we have is primarily high-risk offenders due to risk assessments. The offenders come from the DOC, from the gentleman that just came up here and spoke. And we are limited in capacities that the DOC is not limited into. And I feel as though radio communications are an essential function of the job duties that I perform. I began to initiate conversations through Labor Management Committee under the collective bargaining agreement to look at specifically purchasing new batteries for radio communications. I spent the greater part of 16 months asking for batteries for radio communications within my facility. In the same way that the DOC gentleman explained, that we run line movements on the hour, every hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It doesn't stop. It's closed custody. 16 months to get some batteries. When I got the batteries, The batteries that were purchased were a type of battery that was consistent with the type of model radio that we had, which is a Motorola, and I don't recall. Anyways, bottom line is, it was old as well. So, the purchase of new batteries, basically, we went about 90 days before the new batteries started depleting, because the type of system it requires, there's an energizer or a renewing, just like a renewable battery, that needs to be purchased. But we couldn't purchase it because we didn't have enough money to support safety and security within our institution. The issue is that the statistics for bargaining and negotiating shouldn't be the length of a biennium in order for me to get batteries for communications. It just shouldn't take that long. I'm using the process that's already in place. If the system doesn't provide us with some availability to negotiate batteries for radios or protective gear for cell extraction or latex gloves for searches, I mean, the reality is that what other system do we have? We don't have any other viable resource to go to other than the collective bargaining agreement. And if we're going to continue to utilize the grievance process and go to interest arbitration, we're still wasting time and taxpayer money. So I just would encourage you that statistically, 16 months to get, I think we purchased the 40 new batteries for 90-some employees to have communications with the institution is difficult to swallow.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, could I just ask him, and in all that time, the radios didn't work?
Well, what happened was we kept getting less and less and less and less radios. So what we were asked to do by our management and our administration was to, if we had two staff on the floor, on the unit, one staff carry a radio.
Okay.
So then you switch off. But understand that two staff go two different directions with 10 inmates or 20 inmates. That leaves one staff in an area with no communication. So, it's still difficult to grasp. And along the lines of duress devices, a similar issue occurs as well, that with the knockdown devices that the DOC gentlemen were offering as safety equipment, we have some of the similar gear, and it's very difficult. I myself have been in a knockdown situation, and the response time for our security team is relatively quick. We're talking maybe less than 45 seconds generally for somebody to arrive in the area once the security unit calls out. And I had a device that was semi-defective and went off on the tier below me, not on my tier. So the security team arrives at the tier below and wonders what's going on. There's nothing going on here. Meanwhile, I'm upstairs wrestling and trying to control an inmate. And that's something that we can do. The safety issue is there has to be a process in place so that we can talk about how to get new equipment, to update our equipment, to fix our equipment, and how to communicate in a way that it is proactive. There is dialogue. There is support from management and administration. And ultimately, I know from my institution and on behalf of the Youth Authority, we're investing in the social capital out there. We want to prevent the inmates from going to the DOC. Statistically, 6 out of 10, yes. You want statistics? 6 out of 10 of the juveniles that I have will recidivate and go upstate. It's not great numbers, but it's better than nothing. And so I think that the issue being is the statistics for safety and security shouldn't be 16, 18 months to negotiate for some new batteries. I think it should be relatively a simple process where we can get the information up on the table, look at the cost benefits associated to whatever the safety or security or health issue is, and then begin a dialogue as to how we can reach that common goal.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
My name's Randy Davis. I work at the Oregon State Hospital. I'm a bargaining delegate for SEIU Local 503. I've worked at the state hospital since 1997 as a frontline worker. I work directly with the patients, and I currently work on men's maximum security admissions in Unit 48C, where I bring people in directly from county jails and try to aid them and to get back to court to aid and assist in their own defense. I'm here to speak in favor of 2404 because for years now the hospital has said your staffing is horrible, and I'm sure you're all currently aware of all the things that are going with the state hospital plan. The thing that I like to bring up most when I talk about staffing is, I hate to see this for myself, but the reason patients at the hospital have all kinds of avenues to take care of their safety concerns. Administration sees a patient safety problem, they immediately deal with it. They have a whole procedure set up for that. And they get their concerns dealt with. Frontline workers, well, we talk to management, but then they say, well, maybe that's a bargaining thing. And then when we get to bargaining, well, no, you know, we're prohibited from talking to you about these things, safety, staffing. So patients got upset. There weren't enough frontline workers. There weren't enough people working at the state hospital. What did they do? They went to the Oregon Advocacy Center and initiated a lawsuit, which forced the state hospital to spend $2.6 million to hire more staff. For the last 15 years, frontline workers have been saying, we don't have enough staff. Staffing's not a bargaining issue. Go take it somewhere else. But when the patients bring a lawsuit against the state and force the state to say, open your eyes, your frontline workers have been telling you you need more people, your patients are telling you more people, and we would be hard-pressed, and I, from my DOC brothers aspect, you would be hard-pressed to hear the inmates saying they wouldn't feel safer if they had more correctional officers or more OIA officers inside the facility to help them out. And I view this as a horrible dilemma with the state when the inmates and patients can forcibly use the law to gain staffing, when the people who do the work, who put their lives on the line every day, don't have that opportunity to sit across the table and say, look, we understand what the patients and the inmates are going through. We work with them every day. We know what it's going to take to make this a better environment, to make everyone safer. And by having the ability to sit down at the bargaining table and say, listen, this is what it's going to take, maybe we'll avert more lawsuits by inmates and patients saying there's not enough staff here. You're not taking care of us in the way that you promised, the way the state promised to do business. And I can't speak for local entities. I can't speak for the counties. But I do see that patients come from the county jails. And the first thing they say to me is, man, if the county jail had one or two more sheriff deputies there, that guy who beat the hell out of me, that put me in segregation because I went after him because he called me crazy because I was talking to myself, that might have not happened. And I can only speak from what I see. And from what I see is we have an opportunity here to open a dialogue between management and labor so safety concerns don't become public lawsuits. And the state having their hand forced. Could we have probably done better in staffing under than what the lawsuit came out? I don't know. But it would have been the state saying, look, we worked with our workers and our managers, and the state system knows there's a problem. We're going to fix it. Instead of having a lawyer from outside, from an advocacy center, who brought about a Department of Justice investigation of the hospital because of our staffing issues. These are just some of the things that I like to think about as a public employee, as a person who works for the benefit of others. I don't think anyone who works in the Department of Corrections or anyone who works at the state hospital ever took on the job because they weren't thinking about how to take care of people in the state. Want the legislators to know, we're here to do a job to take care of people. One of the tools we need to take care of people with is the ability to talk to our management about what it's going to take to do the job. And that's all we're asking from this bill. This bill isn't going to run up the dollar amounts on the counties. There's already a law that limits that in arbitration for the last best offer. Boy, I'm running over myself. I just want you as legislators to understand, public people who work in the public sector are there to do good work. We're not there to say, well, we need this and this and this. We're going to run the bill to high heaven. We want the basic standards so when a patient says, I'm not feeling safe to me as a line worker, I can say, look, I got two other people here with me. They're going to make sure that somebody's not going to get you, even if you are a delusional patient who doesn't understand the concepts around you, an unmedicated delusional patient who spent 14 days in a county lockup in segregation in county because he was having a hallucination and got in a fight with another inmate, a very antisocial inmate, who beat him up. And in turn of him beating him up, he threw poo on him. Hey. And he gets termed, and his report from county says, slings feces. He comes to me in a state hospital and says, the only reason I slung feces is because the guy was beating me up. I weigh 115 pounds. He weighed 230 pounds. I crapped myself and threw it at him because I was afraid of getting my ass kicked. Pardon my language.
I've never heard such language in all my life.
I sometimes I've been known to get carried away. People who know me well say, you better watch, you'll drop the F-bomb on you. I'm trying to curtail my language. But we're really here to say is what we want as public safety officers, people who we don't have the right to strike. We can't walk out on you. We don't want to walk out on you. We know our jobs are vital to the public safety of everyone in Oregon. I don't want to walk off my unit at the hospital knowing that no one's going to be there to take care of patients that I talk to every day, that I know what's going on with them. I would never expect me to walk out. But I want to be able to sit down with the management and say, look, we've been telling you for 20 years, we don't have enough staff to do this. We need this piece of equipment. It took almost 10 years to get a plastic shield when we go into a room. It took someone getting their head cracked by a table leg to get shields brought open on our units. I don't want to see the past action like, oh, by the way, 20 people got hurt, so now you get, now maybe we'll talk about staffing, but that's prohibitive. We're not going to talk about that. So I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to our testimony. This is a issue that goes right to the heart of public safety. What is public safety? Public safety is service. And what is service? Service to protect, service to, you know, provide the necessary means for the public to be safe. And to do that, we need the ability to speak to the managers on the bargaining table level, saying, these are real issues. Please listen to us.
I have a question. Earlier, one of the prison guards talked about a simple design change that made it safer when they were parading these folks in and out. On the Oregon State Hospital, which I believe, I hope, we're going to build a new one with money out of this session, are the staff that are currently there, are you being brought into the conversation for the design of that facility now? Because I think you have a lot to offer in designing what's safe and what's not safe.
Chairman Schaffer, there's currently at least one member of the design team was brought in from our local union. There was a number of meetings held on the hospital grounds where they took information from us. I'm not sure where that information goes, but currently I know that the superintendent of the state hospital has solicited ideas from people, but I don't know how much of a real seat we have.
I'm digressing maybe, but I couldn't help asking. Any questions of these gentlemen? Alrighty then. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Keep up the work. And I'd like to call Robert King. Is Robert King, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert King. I'm the president of the Portland Police Association, and I represent 930 police officers, sergeants, detectives, and criminalists in Portland, Oregon. I'm also a member of an organization called the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Along with the other testimony you've heard today, I'd like to ask for your support of House Bill 2404. You've heard mentioned in a variety of different examples the concerns that we have about our ability to talk directly to our employers, to the various employers throughout the state of Oregon about the issue of safety. Generally speaking, in Portland, we have the funding source on things like radios and cars and vests and weapons that that satisfy the concerns that we have. I think we're very fortunate in Portland to have the funding to be able to buy the weapons, the Glocks, that the 9mm versus the 45. the weapons that don't explode in officers' hands. We wear a threat level 3 body armor, which provides us with the level of protection we think that we need on the street. We're very fortunate to have a fire panel in each one of our Crown Victoria police cars that, in the event of a high-speed rear end collision, is designed to protect us from fire and from death. We have a radio system that has undergone improvements. There are still dead spots throughout the city of Portland where officers and firefighters alike cannot communicate either with one another or with dispatch. With respect to safety, we have the same funding level and we have the same number of officers working in the police bureau today that we did 5 years ago. We've endured 5 years of cuts. Cuts are not uncommon throughout the state of Oregon, but we do believe that those cuts and the staffing levels fundamentally undermine the safety of the officers that are working in the street. We need a way to be able to have a conversation with the city of Portland, with the elected officials of the city of Portland, that engages them in a discussion when it impacts our safety. Being responsible for the officers, the sergeants, the detective, and the criminalists in the way that I am, I'm very concerned that we have...
Excuse me. Yes. Move the mic away from your mouth a little bit, because it's coming off crackly over the...
Is that okay? How's that?
Sure
it is. Should I start over? No.
Thanks.
You know, I became the president of the union after working in the bureau for about 15 years, just some years ago now. And in 2004, the Portland Police Association negotiated with the city of Portland over wages and health insurance and a variety of other working conditions issues. The city wanted to implement a reduction in our health insurance. We disagreed. They provided a pay increase to firefighters over the cost of living, and they didn't want to pay it to their police officers. So we ended up in arbitration. We ended up in arbitration on issues that were, some were mandatory and some were permissive. The city wrote its proposals, its last best final offer, to write out all the permissive language in our contract. We were fortunate. In 2004, we went to arbitration. It was a 21-day arbitration. It was the longest arbitration in Oregon's history, and we prevailed. And we protected health insurance for the officers of Portland, and we provided them with a pay increase, and we accomplished a variety of other results on issues that really mattered to them. Now, I am responsible. I am personally responsible for the success and or for the failure of our effort at the bargaining table and in arbitration. And you heard earlier today from Tom Chamberlain that there you take into arbitration what you reasonably or likely believe will produce a victory or will produce a success for you. So my point in my testimony today is we don't have a mechanism to talk about safety over the bargaining table with the employer today. We cannot engage in negotiation or arbitration. We need to be able to, both in Portland as it affects staffing levels and from the horror stories that you've heard today from the corrections officers throughout our state. We need that ability throughout the state of Oregon to provide a level of security and predictability and reliability and protection for the people who protect you. So I just again would reiterate that I don't think that this in any way undermines management right. I don't think that it interferes with the city's ability to function, and that it ultimately does, I think, good for everybody because it gives us a chance to have a discussion about an issue that's, I think, long overdue.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. King? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. King, the previous panel, or at least one of them, made mention of not wanting to walk off the job because of frustration or just inability to deal with some of these issues. And you don't have that option, though, in your job, do you?
We do not have that option. Since, of course, 73, when the collective bargaining laws were written in the state of Oregon, public safety officers are strike barred. Now, I grew up in a union home. My father's a walking boss on the docks. My brother's a longshoreman. As a boy, I remember being on the picket lines with them in the early 70s. And so other workers, the Teamsters, the longshoremen, a variety of other labor groups in the state of Oregon, they have the ability to strike, to take their case to the public and to the elected officials, which, you're right, we, of course, do not have. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, Mr. King, thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right, well, we're going to hear now from opponents or those that are concerned about this bill. I'm going to ask the two folks that wrote down there more than 100 miles away to come first. Jeff Hazen and Richard Lee. Are you all in the... There you are. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler. I'm Jeff Hazen, 811 Hecata, Hammond, Oregon. Former mayor of the city of Warrenton and now currently serve as a Clatsop County Commissioner. And I don't want to go into a long diatribe, but I want to share our concerns that we as Board of Commissions has with this bill. Handed out to you is our letter to you and spells out our concerns, and I just want to go over a few of those. We feel it's unfair to taxpayers, and the reason for that is the decisions concerning the level of publicly provided services should not be made at the bargaining table or as a non-publicly vetted process. It should be out in the open. You know, oftentimes people come to us and share their concerns at our commission meeting. You know, about things dealing with public safety, and we can address those in an open forum. You know, as far as cost-wise, public safety labor costs for Clatsop County have increased 15% more than all other general fund labor costs for the same period. That's from fiscal year 2001-2002 to 2006-2007. There's little doubt that this bill will further accelerate these taxpayer expenses. You know, and the staffing decisions already are, you know, consider employee safety needs. We have a sheriff in our county that, you know, grew up in the department and is, I think, uniquely qualified to make those decisions based on his past experience, having been a deputy sheriff for so many years. Counties nowadays have a lot of things they're dealing with. We're one of three very fortunate counties that don't rely on the county payments program from the federal government, and we thank God every day for that. I look down south at Coos County, and you know, read about what their sheriff has proposed for cuts for staffing, and their board of commissioners has come back and said, no, you need to do more. So they're going to be going from, you know, potentially 190 jail bed spaces down to 50. Add these type of things, and there's just not going to be a jail open in Coos County, I'm afraid. That's all I really have. I'm going to pass the baton to the chairman.
Thank you, Jeff. I am Richard Lee. I'm chairman of the Clatsop County Commission. And... Representative Berger said she wanted some facts, and so I've noticed a lot of this has been anecdotal today. They talk about emotion, they've talked about don't let the baby burn, they've talked about radios, they've talked about towers. That seems to me to be management. Let's talk about what's going to cost the county. The ability to pay, that was brought up, that the judge is going to take a look at the ability of the county to pay. He may very well think that Clatsop County can afford to do this because we're a timber-rich county. But we hired an accounting firm that spent a couple years in designing a process that we could prudently handle our money. And part of that process is that we should not use timber funds to fund the daily operation of our departments. Jeff stated that we had the increase. We had a 46.8 increase, which is 28% over the consumer index for public safety labor costs. Our public safety costs right now are 60.5% of the county's general fund resources. We used our timber money, for instance, to bond our PERS indebtedness, which saved the county over $10 million. We were mandated to have a third judge. We just had to remodel the courthouse to accommodate this third judge at the cost of $4 million. I think we're prudently managing our money, but we have to have the ability to not let an arbitrator take a look and say, you know, they can afford these increased costs. We'll just take some of their pot of timber money over there and transfer it over. That's not what the accounting firm has told us is the prudent way to handle our money. So I think we are involved in public safety. We have a sheriff that's doing a good job down there. I think he's has a good training program. I think these are issues that he has to be able to address and bring to the county, not an arbitrator telling us how we're going to do it. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Any questions for these gentlemen?
Alrighty then. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you. Steve Bryant, Paul Snyder, and Jim Fairchild, please.
Mr. Chair, if we could, we have three city officials here. If we could bring them up at the same time, we have the council president from the city of Kaiser.
I have them on the list.
And could he join us?
If there's room up here, they can. I have them all on the list, though.
Have Paul come up maybe with the next panel.
That's fine. I have no problem with that. Thank you. So that would be Mr. Walsh from Kaiser? Yeah, please, come on up. Just don't let me forget.
Mr. Snyder.
Whoever we're remembering here.
We city folks have to stick together.
I don't want to forget anybody, though, so remind me.
Thank you very much.
Please, go ahead. Because I don't want anybody thinking that anybody didn't get a chance to speak here. I'm hypersensitive to that. Go ahead.
My name is Steve Bryant, and I am the interim legislative director for the League of Oregon Cities. And I'm going to speak last. I'm going to let these two gentlemen introduce themselves.
Chair Schaffler. Members of panel, I'm Jim Fairchild, the mayor of Dallas. I just handed out a paper which from the mayor of Tigard, who was unable to be here today, and it basically expresses many of the points that I'm going to be talking to. As was pointed out through this, the collective bargaining system here, including the staff and workplace issues, have identified that if they have a direct and substantial effect on the job safety of public employees is now what's the current language. And I think that's really been a good choice of language, since it does allow some latitude for flexibility, which is needed because the cities of Oregon I'm getting over a cold and I've made a problem.
You want a glass of water?
No, I'm fine. Okay. I'll give them there. What it amounts to here is that in listening to the testimony, I find that what I'm really, and I'm going to go and step over and put the mayor hat on, I think right now a simple solution is trying to solve an extremely complicated situation. And I don't know that what I see here is really the solution, is what it amounts to. And if I had this in my city, that's the direction I would personally be tempted to perhaps go. But with having said that, I think that it's obvious there's no cookie cutter here. All kinds of different things have to be taken into consideration. And the result here is that if you put the wording of House Bill 2404, it would make staffing and safety levels a mandatory part of the collective bargaining. Not that they're not important, but it also then would tie it into what is the last best offer. And I'll tell you what, the last best offer as a city mayor and for my council just scares the dickens out of us, because if anything, it's kind of like a little bit of a club or a threat or this type of thing, where it would take away our control to go and handle, if you want to call it, the local objectives and things within it. And so that bothers me. There's 242 incorporated cities in the state of Oregon. Out of those, only 32 are larger than 15,000. That leaves 210 cities that are down where I am. And the rules and problems that we face in a city of, for example, Portland, of 500,000, are not very applicable to the things that my town of Dallas, 14,000, run into. I will be the first to agree that the police officers and firefighters all need that same basic training and certification, no matter what the size of the community, because let's face it, they face the same primary hazards and the need to be effective and work together across jurisdictional lines and all this sort of thing. So I have absolutely no objections to the, you know, this right here. However, the day-to-day role of the officers in Dallas is very, very different from those that I've just heard here in the various state institutions, as well as in Dallas. At the same time there, the same thing applies to our firefighters, too, which would be involved in this. Now, we're not going to have very many high-rises, four stories as high as we go. Once in a while, we may be called in here to Salem. So what it amounts to is, I think flexibility is needed here, and I feel that by pulling this in, that the availability in, as far as manpower and the situation, it is taking away from our ability at the local level to do this. Maybe 550 are severely limited government resources. Most cities have worked very hard to fund public safety, water, sewer, and roads at a level that they feel is adequate for their citizens. Any new mandates in a collective bargaining arena without corresponding increases in revenue would require a reduction in some area of public service. As mayor, I feel that I and the members of my city council are the best in the best position to determine where the city's limited resources go. Public safety comes out of the city's general fund, which, as I'm certain all of you know, which, like the state, is actually a very limited fund. Currently, public safety is receiving the largest share from the general funds of most cities. The Mayor McArdle of Independence told me that 80% of their city's general funds went to police. In Dallas, police and fire use 60% of our city's general funds, and we're lucky because we have a volunteer fire department. The police and fire, and over the past few years, the police budget has increased 10%, while the general fund budget has only increased 4.5%. In talking with other mayors and city managers, I find that Dallas's financial picture to be very, very similar to other cities across the state in dealing with the smaller cities. In general, I believe most cities have worked very hard to meet adequate staffing and adequate safety levels. From a personal standpoint, I find myself looking at the safety of the Dallas police and firefighters, or in fact that any employee or citizen, in a very personal way. These are the kids that I've taught. These are the kids that I, my kids have gone to school with. I sit with them on the bleachers on Friday night. I pray with them at church on Sunday mornings. These are my friends, my neighbors. And what I want, and I've, if you go out into these 210 other communities, when you get great big, the personal part starts to drop off a little. But in the majority of the large majority of the cities in Oregon, that's where the mayors and the city councils are coming from. Our friends, our neighbors, and the people that work for us. If something is wrong, I'll tell you what, I'll hear about it very quickly. I don't care where it is. It may be the game on Friday night or the grocery store, but I'll hear about it. And so when it comes down to the safety levels for a community, I feel, and I think that practically all the mayors and the city councils should be doing this. Not somebody who is from out of town and does not recognize what really is happening at the local level. HB 2404 is what I feel perhaps a bill that does not fix really what it is trying to fix, and I think perhaps we should take a long look at it. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And I was on city council. My term ended in 2000, and I'm still hearing about it, so I can appreciate where you're coming from.
And I understand. Your city and mine are pretty close, the same size, too.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Walsh. The mayor can't be here with us today. I'm the mayor pro tem of the Kaiser City Council president, and I'd like to share some of our thoughts. Actually, Mayor Fairchild is his thoughts. I'd like to echo them. I guess the point here is I guess I had a I am thrilled that you're interested in ideas like staffing levels and safety, because of course those are incredibly important. And we spend a tremendous amount of time on the city council level dealing with issues of staffing and safety levels. I mean, one of the main things we hear as elected officials, and I think you could agree, is, you know, safety is number one. And it's always number one. And anyone who wants to run for office and say that I'm not for safety isn't going to make it. Someone who doesn't prove his salt by being strong on safety isn't going to make it. Safety is the number one issue. It always has been, probably always will be, in terms of issues that city councilors and mayors have to struggle with. But there's another issue they have to struggle with, and that's taxes. What are your resources? What do you have available to you? What other needs are there in the community? What other things do the citizens need, want, and cherish? What other things are interplayed with safety, such as after-school programs or education programs or libraries and other things that are important to safety besides just benefits of police officers and staffing levels? You know, there's a tremendous amount of things in other departments that are important. The water department, you have to have safety in there, too. You have to have safety everywhere in the entire community. And with 9/11, you know, it infiltrates every single aspect of everything the city does or ever will do from now on, including how you build a city hall complex we're building, working on right now, and all the different departments involved. So the city council has this 10,000 foot view of what's going on, and that's what we spend all our time trying to do. And so I'm also on the personnel committee, and we're dealing with the negotiating with the police officers and so on. And I remember going through the arbitration process we did last, and we came up with what I thought was, you know, a good balancing act between, you know, health care, which everyone has to deal with, the rising health care costs, and, you know, benefits packages and retirement programs and PERS and everything else we had to deal with. You had to deal with all those, and then you also have to deal with staffing levels. And we really struggled with a lot of that, and we came up with some innovative approaches, we thought, on the health care program, which is we fully funded everything, you know, 100% just a few years ago. But we said, look, this will be a cap, and let's give you a foreshadowing of the future to the unions, to the members, that next year when the prices go up, which we know they will, we're going to add to it by the cost of living increases, but that's it. We have to cap that. And what happened was remarkable. It was amazing. The next year what happened is the individual members of the union had to pay a little bit of money. They had to pay a percentage, and it started growing a little bit. And then we found something incredible. A tremendous amount of the employees were double insured. A lot of them had insurance with their spouse or with other insurance companies, and they were double insured. So they said, well, why would I pay the $114 here when I can be fully insured with my wife's policy or with my husband's policy? And so some of them elected not to pay the $119, and they were still fully insured. So everyone was still enjoying full insurance in one way or another. And what happened was there was a tremendous larger pot of money for the remaining people in the city, and so we were able to give them better benefits and higher benefits, and we were able to contain costs. Of course, we took that. That was challenged, taken to arbitration, and they said, no, you can't do that. That's not normal. You do what everyone else does, and so we ended up paying 90% like everybody else, and that whole concept got thrown out. Everyone came back to our plan, and we ended up with double-insured people now, their husbands and wives coming into the city pot because now our plan was better than theirs. So... And the arbitrator said we could afford it. He said, you know, that's affordable. Well, yeah, I suppose it was. But we had to eliminate the volunteer coordinating position, our only one that we had budgeted that year. We had to eliminate it. We also had to give up any dreams of a library. We gave up any dreams of any park department worth a darn. And we had to limit our funding for the peer program to $1,000 per school. $2,000 for an entire after-school program for an entire city of 35,000 people. Well, the arbitrator didn't know those things, so I don't blame him for it. But that's because he's not the city council. He doesn't have the 10,000-foot view of everything going on. He just sees a pile of money, compares it to another pile of money, and compares it to whatever, and says, you guys can afford it. Well, yeah, you can afford it, but what gives? If we had to be in Kaiser, if we had to be quote-unquote normal on our staffing level with a $2.07 per thousand tax base, which is roughly a third of what Salem enjoys, if we had to fund what is normal, we wouldn't have a city. We would need every single penny collected in taxes, every single penny, just to fund a normal taxing level. We're at about 1 per 900 right now. Monmouth, for example, is 1 per 539 or 593. If we had to become anywhere near, we are so low staffed as it is, that if we had to do that, we would cut into these things and we would destroy existing programs. We're down to one person on the Parks Board. The arbitrator didn't care about that when he ruled the way he did. We did add a police officer, but thank goodness we got grants. It allowed us to enjoy the grant program. So we worked very hard for those types of things. But my point is that you know, the city council is the one that looks for public safety in terms of staffing levels and how much can we possibly afford. We added, actually, we did add two police officer positions. Eventually, we found funding for two police officer positions. But you may notice Kaiser doesn't have a library and couldn't afford to pay even a $1,000 grant to get one started. I take that back. We were able to pay up to, we started a grant, just a few thousand dollars. But a few thousand more would have made a huge difference. And if we can actually have enough for an entire person, we could have a librarian. We can't afford that. So, and those things are good for kids too. And if kids don't have a place to go, how much more public safety detriments are you having? And so all I'm saying is if the arbitrator's going to do this and look at staffing levels, they need to look at everything. They need to look at the library. They need to look at the community development department. They need to look at everything. In essence, they need to be city council. And while you're at it, they need to have the right to tax people to pay for it. Because that's what you need in the bottom line. You need to have the money to pay for these things. So I don't think we can expect an arbitrator to take a 10,000-foot view of everything there is. I think that's unrealistic. And so because of that, I think we have to, and I don't think you want to usurp the power of the city council to do their primary function, which is protecting its citizens and staffing it to the highest level possible. Like I said, we're at 80% as it is. We do that job, and all the cities do that job. They do the most they can possibly to protect their citizens and to delegate that essentially to the arbitrator and say he's in the best position to decide where city resources go. I mean, I think it's a slap in the face of the cities, and I think of all the city councils that are working hard to protect their citizens, and I think there's a better way. And I think that it's a good idea. Staffing levels are important, but I think that's our job. Just to be blunt.
Any questions? All right. Thanks, gentlemen.
Sheriff Shopler, I have some remarks, if
yes.
I may. Again, Steve
and
Ryan.
And will one of you nice men make room for... there's another city person on here.
Yeah.
Mr. Barry from the city of Salem.
Sure.
Please. Just keep things going here. Go ahead.
Chair Shopler again. Steve Bryant with the League of Oregon Cities. I spent 32 years working for the city of Albany, the last 16 of which was as city manager in Albany, where we dealt with these issues. And it's important for you to recognize that we sympathize with most of what we heard today. In fact, we would agree with much of the testimony that you heard today. We have folks out there that have genuine safety concerns on the job. And we want to emphasize that the current law requires that we bargain those issues which have a direct and substantial effect on on-the-job safety. That's the current law. We want to take you back to a time where all of the sides came together and out of a very delicate and extensively negotiated process, we ended up with what was known then as Senate Bill 750 in 1995. And Senate Bill 750 emerged from the smoke as a carefully balanced, reconstructed process to ensure that these strike-barred employees were treated fairly, and that our arbiters were given clear criteria for making decisions in their binding arbitrations. Our primary point that you're hearing from us today, that any effort to change the foundational underpinnings of Senate Bill 750 without thoroughly examining the consequences, or that whole concept to us is fraught with peril. And we need to look at how we got to where we're at and be careful about changing that balance. It's important for us that we clearly separate the three issues that are in this bill, one of which has not even been addressed today, and it could become critically important. The three issues in the substantive sentence that's in this bill, you'll find it on page 2, lines 21 through 23. And that is the issues of staffing levels, which you've heard much about, the issue of on-the-job safety, which we've heard a lot about, and the issue of workload issues, which we've not heard about. The language in this bill would make all three of those, including workload of the employees, potentially a subject for mandatory bargaining. With regard to staffing levels, I don't think I need to say much more. You've heard about our concern for maintaining local control over staffing levels. We've got a process. At the local level, you have it at the state level for determining how to allocate preciously scarce resources. if you were to have a process where staffing levels for state police and corrections officials were determined at the collective bargaining table, you'd have a much different policymaking process than you have today. And I'd ask you to consider, do you want staffing levels to be decided at the bargaining table or in the budget-making process that you go through? Well, we have that same issue at the city council level. Second, with regard to on-the-job safety, nothing is taken more seriously by our elected officials, as you've heard, and our managers than the safety of our employees. We train extensively on safety issues. We hold our managers accountable to their employees' safety record. We, of course, are required to comply with all of the state and federal laws with regard to safety that you know about and that have been referred to. We would argue that it's not only a good idea to ensure that we're working safely, it's fiscally prudent to do it. Our insurance rates are affected by our safety records, and so we as managers pay very close attention to safety issues. And all of the issues that you heard today are issues that any decent manager has an obligation to listen to and to respond to. It simply would be unacceptable to me as a city manager to take anything I heard today and ignore it. It should be referred to a safety committee, it should be investigated, and it should be dealt with. And if that's not happening at the state level, then there's something wrong in the state process, and we'd ask you not to impose that at the local level. And then lastly, the workload issue that's in this language, that's hidden in this bill. I urge you to take a look at that. Do you really want to subject every potential workload issue that employees deal with to the collective bargaining table as a mandatory subject of bargaining? Because I guarantee you it will become a very long, lengthy, drug-out process that will be difficult for us to contend with at the local level. Just a couple of words about the arbitration process. We would even argue that the Senate Bill 750 isn't perfect either. There are problems with SB 750, and if we're going to open that issue, we ought to open it all up and take a look at how it's working in this state. You should know that as of today, there are 68 arbiters that are on the approved list of the Employee Relations Board. 43 of those 68 are out of state. They don't pay taxes here. They don't vote here. They don't understand the issues as we know them. And yet we are left to accept the decisions that they make as binding. There is no appeal process. We have no recourse until to wait till the next contract opens up to discuss those issues. Labor is doing pretty well in this environment. Labor has won 9 out of the last 10 cases that have gone to arbitration. And I congratulate them for that. And you know what? Managers are very reluctant to take issues to binding arbitration because we know that. And so we are very anxious to try to solve our collective bargaining issues at the local level. So I just would conclude with a couple of things that this is an important issue to us. Just one example. You heard a lot about the need for communication to be bargained. And we're concerned about interoperability in how we operate. I know the state is, too. The last I looked, the governor has about $600 million in the budget to resolve our interoperability problems. And I just ask this question. Do you want that kind of issue to be decided at the collective bargaining table, or does it need to be decided in the public policy arena that we all operate in? And I would contend that's where it belongs and where it works best. We're concerned about it, but we have a different process for resolving those kinds of issues. So we're very appreciative of these concerns. We absolutely agree with labor's plea to just be able to sit down and talk about safety issues. I agree. We all would agree with that. We need a forum for those discussions. They must be addressed. Our employee safety is of paramount concern to us, but this isn't the process for that discussion. So I appreciate your time and be happy to answer any questions.
Let's let Mr. Berry go first, and then we'll open it up.
George Berry, here is the Labor Relations Administrator in the City of Salem. The City of Salem opposes this. I'll keep my testimony short because much of what I had to say has already been spoken about. This body did, in 1995, rework the collective bargaining law, and Mr. Bryant had mentioned it, that labor has just won 9 out of the last 10. More importantly, it seems to me that since 1995, there have been 82 arbitration in the state of Oregon. Unions have won 44, and the employers have won 38. I think the goal of collective bargaining is balance. We're pretty close to balanced. If we set staffing levels as being a mandatory subject to bargaining, we have to then deal with the firefighter union that says four-man engines are safer than three-man engines, and two officer patrol cars are safer than one police officer patrol cars. We have to deal with that. The only alternative we have to deal with that, to avoid going to arbitration, to get some out-of-state arbitrator telling us that we know that that is safer, is to offer more money to get those issues and get them settled. It's going to drive our cost of public safety far beyond where they need be. Safety is an issue in Oregon, always has been. Every public employer in Oregon is required to comply with our OSHA. That includes a safety committee made up of at least 50% of the bargaining unit members. They can bring every issue of safety to that committee. They can discuss those issues with management. Issues that cannot be or won't be addressed could be taken to the state in the way of a formal complaint, and OSHA can investigate those matters. This is not the forum to deal with safety issues. Safety issues that come up on a daily basis of a job need to be addressed on a daily basis, not once every 3 or 4 years at the collective bargaining table. Staffing and safety are already a mandatory subject of bargaining if they present a direct and substantial effect of on-the-job safety. Recently, there was one of the arbitration decisions that happened at Yam Hill with parole and probation officers who wanted to be armed on the job. That was a management right to decide they weren't armed. They took that issue to arbitration, and the arbitrator decided to arm parole and probation officers. Safety can be taken to arbitration. I would request that this body oppose 2404. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for our panel, including the good mayor of Dallas? Any questions? Well, guys, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
And don't forget Mr. Snyder.
Well, I will, certainly will not. I'm going to call Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Snyder, please. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties and appearing today in opposition to House Bill 2404. I want to reiterate the comments that have already been made very artfully by others. I just want to mention a couple of things. One is the relationship of the phrase potential impact to the phrase a direct and substantial effect. The difference between those two, up until the time that I heard testimony from the proponents today, I'm assuming that this was a substantially lower standard for getting something to mandatory bargaining. But from some characterization by several of the proponents of the bill, it sounded to me as though they were talking about dealing proactively, prospectively with issues before they become something that's already been experienced. Now, if that's what's intended by the phrase potential impact, and I'd like to hear more about that. But the way it sounded to me before that testimony was given was that basically one side says this is a safety issue, the other says no, it's not. Now, under this criteria, then one side could say, yeah, but it's a potential impact. And so we don't have to show you that it's got an actual impact or that it's got a substantial impact. We just need to say it's got a potential impact. It would be good to have some clarification on that issue. One issue that has been alluded to by the commissioners from Clatsop County that I'd just like to emphasize, and that is I think most employers, all employers, view this legislation as something that's going to create a cost that isn't there now. And one of the issues that we have with respect to that is the potential loss of revenues that counties are facing, some much more than others, from the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act that the federal government has not reauthorized. And the amount of total losses to the state of Oregon, most of which falls to county general funds and to county road funds, is $230 million a year, a grand total of $460 million for the biennium. As I'm sure Representatives Esquivel and Edwards know, it's going to hit some counties incredibly harder than others. And so we're just trying to preserve the ability of counties to function properly, and we're concerned that as a result of this legislation, if it plays out the way that all employers, I think it will, is that it's going to add an additional burden that doesn't exist now. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you. Ken?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ken Armstrong. I represent the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. I've also been asked to pass on to you that the Special Districts Association of Oregon and also APCO-NENA joined me in opposition to House Bill 2404. You have heard today a lot of testimony on some big issues, on some very small technical issues, and I'm not going to rehash all of that. There is the record on this issue is huge. It's long, as you, I think, most of you well know. This is now the third session that you've been dealing with this issue and other issues that are part of a similar package that have been introduced over on the Senate side. You've heard the arguments for three straight sessions. You have seen the same people up in front of you now for the third straight session. What this issue seems to always come down to is who's got the most votes. Well, of course that's the case. This is the legislative process. But it seems to me that adjustments to the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act should not be just an issue of counting the votes in either chamber of the legislature, but it should be more of a holistic examination of what the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act really is all about. Senate Bill 750, in our view, has some flaws, and it's got some things that it does very well. I don't think you'll find either management or labor saying that it does a marvelous job of anything, but it does seem to result in management and labor splitting about 50-50 on how the arbitration awards go. So what we would like to see, rather than this sort of a arm wrestling approach on individual piecemeal elements to the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, much better for our legislature would be to say we need to take a look at the broad law, we need to see what needs to be fixed, what does both sides feel like they need to get out of it, how could that be done in a responsible, rational way, rather than just have a political brawl in front of the legislature every time the session convenes. That's where we come from on this issue. Can I say that the sky is going to fall if this bill passes? I can't say that. Do any of us know what the implications are going to be? No, we really don't. I think both sides have made cases of what their view is. I don't think we know. I think what we need to do is we need to take a broader view of the entire issue and not pass things on a piecemeal basis. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. I just wanted to say I've been in this legislature now, this side of the legislature, for this is my third term, and I don't think this has been before this committee before, just for the record. If I remember right, I don't think the firefighter public safety and staffing issue has been before the Labor Committee or Business Labor Consumer Affairs Committee in the last two sessions. So just for the record, I wanted to clarify that. Has been at the Senate side, but not here. And secondly, I've watched you work in this building now for three sessions, and you can count votes with the best of them. I just wanted to point that out too. Anyway, any questions for these fine gentlemen here who I respect greatly? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not a question, but just a comment that, in response to your last comment, that I would agree with you. It would be great if everybody could come to the table and, you know, come to some consensus about how to make these changes, but my recollection is that's not quite the process that resulted in Senate Bill 750 passing. I mean, I was not in the legislature, but I do remember it, and I remember some very, very bitter battles over that bill and some pretty close votes by which it passed. So, you know, I don't know that that is a model for the kind of process that you're talking about, and perhaps this bill being before us is somewhat of a reaction to that process. The pendulum tends to swing eventually. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I wouldn't necessarily suggest that Senate Bill 750 or the process that developed it was perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it has resulted in a situation where both sides are equally perhaps unhappy, and perhaps that's not a bad legislative result. And so that's sort of the direction I'd like to see us go. And Mr. Chair, just in response to your comment, I was not specifically referring to bills coming in front of this committee, but in front of the Oregon legislature.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Anything else? Representative Holdy, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this is really a tough issue. There's no doubt about it. You recognize the revenue impacts, you know, potentially. But, you know, I'm listening to all this, and, you know, safety is a big issue. And, you know, if our employees that are in the public safety arena aren't safe, I really worry that we're not going to have them in the future. They're going to quit. And where are we going to get the people to provide our safety? And, you know, though this bill seems to have financial implications, I guess, of having to negotiate mandatory safety issues and where those might end up, it is still something that's on the table to talk about, and nothing says that how that bargaining is going to end up at the end of the day. I don't think there's anything in this bill that says you have to accept, you know, anything on the table, you know. So, you know, I know that's, it's not all that simple, but, you know, I just think that if the system was working the way it was, we wouldn't have all these public safety people in here telling us we got to do something about their safety because they're protecting us, and if they're not safe, I think our whole system's in jeopardy. So, just a comment, going to have to think about this one for a little bit.
Anybody else have any more questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My pleasure. I'd like to call Mark Adams and Dave Burright. And if there's anyone else who's compelled to testify today, please let me know, because if there's no one else, I'll be calling Daryl Gerritsen after these gentlemen. And that'll be it. Go ahead, Bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dave Burright. I'm the executive director for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and prior to accepting this position, I was with the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office for 29 years. And during that time, I came up through the ranks and was very proud to serve as their sheriff for the last 10 and a half years of my career at that organization. I'm here today representing all of Oregon's 36 sheriffs, and we would like to urge you to oppose this particular piece of legislation. The thing that's a little incredible to me, and we've alluded to that, I think, throughout the day, is that, you know, on its face, this bill would appear to be something that everyone ought to be in favor of and want to support, because I think for the most part, we all support our public safety personnel. You know, and the sheriffs do, I do, I've been there in my career. I clearly remember as a young deputy several times working graveyard where I was the only car out in rural Linn County for all of 2,300 square miles. And we didn't have a whole lot of staff to begin with. There were only three of us assigned to that graveyard shift. One was on vacation, one had called in ill. And so that left me. And so that meant I was just very careful that night when I was out on patrol. The thing that I think is the biggest problem that we've talked about today is this bill would make staffing and safety issues to be mandatory subjects of bargaining if they have the potential impact. And that's really the key word throughout the entire bill, potential impact on the on-the-job safety and the workload of the employees. And as you've already talked about, the current law says there must be a direct and substantial effect, which I think that's really fair and reasonable. That provides boundaries, at least with that type of language. There's some boundaries. You know, at least stay between the white lines going down the road. But at least, you know, everyone has at least some direction about where you're going when we talk about those particular words. I've heard today that There are places where we can't talk about safety, and that's hard for me to fathom. I don't doubt that it is that way, and I share some concerns with some of the things that I've heard here today. But all safety issues are permissible to talk about. When it comes to this bill, however, the devil is in the details. Because when I'm talking with others about this bill, I just challenge them. I say, well, tell me, what doesn't have a potential impact on public safety? Talking to my wife about it this weekend, she was asking me what I was going to be doing on Monday, and I said I was going to be up here and, testifying on this bill, and she got to talk. Of course, she's a police officer's ex-wife, and so she's been around the business some. She started throwing things out to me. I said, no, that is. She couldn't come up with anything. It really didn't have a potential impact. The problem is the word potential has no boundaries. It is everything. And that's one of the places where I have a real issue with this particular bill. And I wouldn't want anyone to think that management, I don't care who they are, whether they be sheriffs or chiefs or firefighters or city council persons or county commissioners, that we don't care about the safety of our staff, because of course we do. And again, I've been in their position. I've always got so amused with, especially in my later days, when I'm talking to the brand new staff at the sheriff's office. They think about the old man and they forget that I ever worked the road. How does the sheriff know anything about it? I've been there, folks. I have been out there and done that job. And you've heard today, the safety conditions in our workplace are monitored by a lot of different places. Virtually everybody has safety committees. I know that. In my own shop, I had a couple, really. I had what we called our employee council, and that was made up of people from throughout our organization. And I encouraged them to come and bring any and all issues to us. Didn't have to be bargaining. Didn't have to be anything else. If there's something on their mind, that's why I wanted to hear it then. I didn't want to have to go to a bargaining type issue. It shouldn't have to go there. I want to hear about it. We've heard about guns. I had a firearms committee. When we went, just now I'm really showing my age, went from wheel guns, revolvers, to semi-automatics, I got together all my firearms experts, my range masters and others, and I says, I need to hear from you. What is it that we should be looking towards going to in our office? And that's what we did there. And I don't think that I'm unique in this situation. But what this bill does, I really think, is really ties the hands of management and the persons responsible for paying the bills. And I think that's something we've got to be very, very careful of. The thing that I might vary from in some of the previous testimony that you've heard is we talked about the costs. And you know what? This is a zero-sum game. In fact, for some counties that are losing timber money, maybe it's a negative-sum game. But, neither the state nor local government has unlimited resources. And because of that, I don't think, by personal opinion, this bill is going to cost you very much. Not in the way of tax dollars. It's not going to cost very much. Because if we have an issue go before an arbitrator who rules on a staffing issue that says, I can't believe they go two persons to a car. I hope they would never go there. But more reasonable, they might say, you got to have a certain number of people on a shift. You can't have just three people at a fire station, you need four, whatever the case may be. The problem is, we don't print our own money. And so what it means really for this bill is there will be a decrease in services, a drop in service to the public. That's what it means. Right now, you all in this building are struggling with trying to bring the Oregon State Police's numbers back up to a level where at least they have a chance of providing 24-hour coverage around the state. But I don't think in my previous experience around here that you guys would come back into session because an arbitrator just said that, no, you've got to have more state troopers in order to have minimum staffing out on the road. Same thing would apply to DOC or any place else that we're talking about in state government. The counties and the cities, I don't think, are any different. If I were faced with that dilemma when I was the sheriff, as much as I might not want to do it, it might mean I close down my graveyard shift. I don't have anyone to respond. What it means is that I close wings of the jail because I don't have enough staff to do the minimum staffing.
Same thing applies to the fire service. If they don't have enough people to provide four persons per station, that means you close the station so you can move your staff and you limit the number of stations that you have. So it does mean, I think the bottom line to this is that it will be a drop in service. And you know, you remember my lonely graveyard shift I talked about. Well, let me also tell you, though, the sheriff didn't like that. He and I talked about it. And the dispatcher, there was only one dispatcher back then, they didn't like that either. And I know I was certainly not thrilled with it. But there were only two choices. Because we weren't a big enough office to bring people back in. There wasn't anybody to bring back in. So either I went out and I worked that shift, and the dispatcher, bless her soul, kept very close track of me, and I was very careful, or else I sat in the courthouse. And when people called and said, my home's being broken into, or we've just got this motor vehicle accident and we need help, we'd have to say, I can't go because there's only one of me. So that was never an option. That was never an option. And I have to agree, I think, with Ken, who spoke before me, that I think it's obvious that neither labor nor management is really happy with the current state of affairs. There are issues with the current process. But I certainly do agree also that the solution to this is not to handle this in a piecemeal fashion. I think that the proper way to do this is to have all the sides come together. And I agree, Representative Rosenbaum, that it would not be easy. But if it's not working, then we need to talk about it and figure out a way to fix it and bring back to you a solution rather than handle it in a piecemeal fashion. Thank you.
Chair Schaffler, committee members, for the record, my name is Mark Adams. I'm the Chief of Police for the Kaiser Police Department, but I'm here today representing the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I want to thank you for your opportunity to speak to you and for your attention. I know it's getting to be a long hearing. The OACP strongly opposes passage of House Bill 2404, and our reasons for the opposition are pretty simple. Our law currently, our collective bargaining laws currently provide binding arbitration, and I think it's working. We've heard testimony over and over about that. But I want to tell you that employee safety, and I know that's a concern, is job one with any police chief I know of in this state. I've been in law enforcement in Oregon for over 27 years. I've been a police officer. I've been a union president. And I've been a chief of police for the last 14 years. I can't recall ever in my career having a safety issue situation where we couldn't get it addressed somehow. I can remember, I was laughing the other day, my first day in a police car and how stressed out I was. It was three toggle switches to worry about. And, you know, they explained to me, well, you have these lights because it makes it safe for you to go, and you have these alley lights so you can look down the alley and all that. Over the years, I've seen all of that change. And most of those changes, as the technology came along, changed because management and labor, we got together. We said, how can we do this safer? You know, the rule I always use is to make us safer, more efficient, more effective. And that's the measuring stick. You know, when I was in the shooting and only had a six-shot revolver, and we realized the bad guys are now carrying semi-automatics, it didn't take much at all to go to the boss and say, hey, we've got to look at this. We formed a firearms committee. We came up with a semi-automatic. Later in my career, they decided that type of semi-automatic is probably not the best. We formed a committee. We changed guns. In fact, since I've been a chief, we've done that twice in two different departments. We have safety committees that meet regularly, proactively, to look for what are we doing and can we do it safer. We do debriefings after every major incident. What did we do right? What did we do wrong? How can we do it safer? We started out, I believe, originally with an 8-week basic police academy, then a 10-week basic police academy. We listened to our employees saying, that ain't enough, boss. Now we have a 16-week basic police academy, thanks to the legislature, and a brand new academy to do it in. We've gone to scenario training. We spend a lot of money in training, and it's kind of funny. Well, it's not really funny, but I look at the stats in my department. Our number one on-the-job injury, training. It happens during training, not out in the field. They get hurt, training not to get hurt. In fact, I was looking at the other day, you know, if you want a dangerous job, be a roofer. Their on-the-job injury rate's a lot higher than being a police officer. We've come up with plans to rotate our ballistic vests. I can remember when ballistic vests first came out, and there was some departments, you know, they, well, we don't need those, but they talked about it. We never had to go to the
arbitration or a union matter and fight for vests, we got the vests. Now we rotate them every 5 years because the manufacturer says can't guarantee them after 5 years. That didn't take any kind of an arbitration ruling. Minimum staffing. My department, and I think I'm pretty much an example of every department around the state, we came up with our own minimum staffing. We met with the guys and said, what do you think's the bottom line? And my department happens to be three cars. We can't go below three. We have to call on people on overtime. We have to mandate somebody come in on overtime. It doesn't hardly ever happen, but we won't go below three. And we continue to increase spending and training, again, always with safety in mind. You know, we've gone from, you know, batons to pepper spray to tasers. All these things all came in to try to make our employees safer out there and to make the public safer. In the city of Kaiser now, out of every dollar that comes into the general fund, 78 cents of it goes to the police department. Out of every dollar that comes to the police department, I'm spending 83 cents on personnel costs. So if I'm math right, that leaves me 17 cents to operate the rest of the department. 17 cents for gas, for cars, bullets, light bulbs, whatever. There's not a whole lot of wiggle room in there. And we've been very successful using the current labor laws to get together and say, guys, we're going to do everything we can for you. Let's try to work for a synergistic, you know, resolution of this thing. And 9 times out of 10, we get there. We went to arbitration this past year over health care. And it wasn't so much the city thought we could win. It was just that the city thought, we just can't get in. The public's going to kill us if we just hand out additional money when nobody, no other jobs are getting that. We went, we lost, we paid up. But that had to come out of that 17 cents somewhere. You know, you had to squeeze it down. So I'm concerned that if we change the House Bill 2404 passes, and we're in there having some arbitrator who doesn't know the local scene, who doesn't know all these things, making decisions for us, we're going to end up somebody telling us how many police officers per thousand we have to have. I worked for a city that had a city charter amendment, a city in Oregon, where we had to have 1.87 police officers per thousand. I was a union president when that happened. Boy, I thought we had one today. We discovered with budget time, yep, we had 1.87 police officers per thousand, but we had to drive our cars another couple of years. We lost half our support staff. So just you can't. There was no money machine out there that could make any more money for the budget. We couldn't tax anybody anymore. And we realized that this wasn't the way to go. We were actually, we might have had more people, but we ended up operating with less safety. That's all I have for you.
Yeah, thank you. I'm familiar with roofing, and I don't remember a time anybody going to shoot at me when I was up on the roof. But anyway, that's the difference between being a police. Yep. God bless you for doing your work. I don't mean to make light of that. Any questions for these gentlemen? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank
please.
You, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate your testimony, and you raise a point that I've heard quite a few witnesses raise earlier, which seems to be that it's not going to be possible to discuss these issues in a safety committee or make changes that would be sensible ones short of getting into an adversarial bargaining or arbitration situation. I guess I don't see anything in this bill that says you can't fix things when they need to be fixed. I would think that would be the goal of the union and management, to prevent things from coming into that situation by fixing them as early as possible.
Chairman Schaffer, Representative Rosenbaum, I agree. The current law, if it's that bad, if it's a direct and substantial safety issue is not being addressed, it's already subject to bargaining. That's why I don't see the need to change the law. It's working now. These issues, and I heard some horror stories today, I'm thinking, my goodness, who's the manager there? I mean, there's rules against some of this. If my guys have to go in someplace where there's feces and blood and urine being thrown around, they're violating policy if they don't put on the gear that's been provided for them before they go into that kind of situation. So I think those things are being answered. I don't think you can, an arbitrator can improve on that at all.
Any more questions? All righty then. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. All right. Would Daryl Gerritsen please come and as briefly and as possible address some of the concerns we've heard about this bill, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Daryl Gerritsen. I'm an attorney. I practice labor law on behalf of several police associations, including many of the ones mentioned here. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, Federation of Oregon Police Parole and Probation Officers, and the Tigard Police Association. I think you could summarize almost all of the opposition testimony that while they don't dispute the legitimacy of the safety concerns, they all say we should go someplace else. They don't want to go to the bargaining table. And I'm going to tell you why someplace else doesn't work, and I'm going to start with OROSHA. In 1993, OROSHA issued a citation to the city of Canby because they had only one officer on graveyard shift and the nearest backup was approximately 30 minutes away. The chiefs and sheriffs went down to OROSHA. It was issued under the general duties test. The general duties test in OROSHA law is that the employer will provide a safe workplace. They went down and they lobbied OROSHA not to issue a citation based on the general duties test, consistent with a Washington decision that said you can't deal with staffing through general duties. So OROSHA was no longer available. The citation was quashed. No further action was taken. There was an agreement that we would have a committee of labor and management to look at equipment standards and perhaps staffing standards for public safety. That committee met off and on for approximately 5 years. Its product was zero. To this date, for police officers and parole and probation officers, and I believe corrections officers, there is no equipment standard. Even the state of Washington has established a vest standard, a ballistic vest standard, that all public safety agencies must provide. We do not even have that standard in the state of Oregon. Now, one of the problems with OROSHA is that if OROSHA chooses not to cite, the employees have no appeal right. So you call in OROSHA, they come in, for whatever reason they choose not to cite whoever the investigator is, and I will tell you some OROSHA investigators are good and some are not so good. No citation issues, the employees are left with no remedy. But what happens if a citation issues? Then the employer is fined. So the money that could be used to remediate the safety issue now has to be paid to OROSHA as a fine. That also makes no sense. Now, safety committees were also mentioned. There's a couple problems with safety committees, and they're mandated under statute. The first problem is they're usually employer-wide. So you're dealing with how many people are going to move the hot macadam off the public works truck, and what kind of boots do the public works people have. And they are not public safety specific. The second problem is there's no mandate that a safety committee recommendation be implemented. So how does bargaining change this? Bargaining changes it because it makes the employer have to come to the table, have to discuss the issue, and it moves the issue off the dime. Because I also heard several of the opponents mention, well, we could study it. We could look at it. I'll tell you right now, the city of Tigard bought new radios a year ago, hopefully to solve some of the dead spots. Those radios are still in the box. They're in the box because all the technicians are arguing about templates and whether the right template is going to be in place. The Tigard Police Officers Association has no mechanism to move them off dead center. Now, I think Sheriff Burright was right when he said this bill really isn't going to cost very much. It is going to force the employer to have to address issues. But no arbitrator is going to bankrupt a jurisdiction. You have to understand how arbitrators are selected. First of all, arbitrators earn their living being arbitrators. Labor arbitrators, that's what they do full time. When you go to arbitration, you get a list of 7 arbitrators along with their resumes. Now, on the labor side, we keep track of who's been naughty and nice, and I tell you on the management side, they keep track of who's been naughty and nice. And you flip a coin, and whoever loses the coin flip has to strike the first name. The person selected is the one that's least objectionable to both sides. Now, if you want to earn your living as an arbitrator, you're not going to make a stupid decision that bankrupts a jurisdiction. you'll never work again. The process doesn't work that way. Now, every post-750 arbitration is on the net. If you go to the Employment Relations Board, they have the text of every one of those decisions. And I know you guys have an awful lot to read, but I think if you peruse those decisions, you'll see that arbitrators are not idiots. They're not stealing the taxpayers' money. They are deciding cases in a fair and balanced way. And let me tell you, part of the problem with the bargaining process, the commissioner from Clatsop County said, well, they should come talk to us. Well, that's an unfair labor practice for us to go around the management negotiator and talk to them directly. We can't do that. And the county commissioners don't come to the bargaining table. To a large extent, unless you can raise it at bargaining, issues get filtered through the bureaucracy, for lack of a better term, and never reach the decision makers. Or the decision makers study it, and the solution never comes down. Now, Representative Berger raised the issue of substantial. And I'm going to give you an example in regard to the famous corrections cocktail that you guys have all heard so much about. And it happens in every correctional institution. At the state pen, there are a certain number of cells that are fitted with plexiglass shields so that if the inmate throws the cocktail, it just splashes them back and doesn't get the officer. Every time an inmate who is not in a plexiglass shield cell throws a cocktail, and we raise it as a bargaining issue that there aren't enough shielded cells, they move the inmate. And then they say, it's no longer an issue. Where's your substantial immediate impact? And so corrections has used as a shell game, at least that's my phrasing. They probably have a different explanation. But they have basically moved troublesome, every time we've raised the safety issue, because it's generally inmate specific, they just simply move the inmate and we get no proactive solution. Solution to the cocktails, quite simply, is changing the number of cells and changing the classification system of inmates so that you can make sure that the identified cocktail throwers are placed in those kind of cells. But we can't bargain because there's no immediate substantial impact on safety. Same with vests. Right now, there is no specification as the threat level on vests. So therefore, if the employer provides vests, we can generally make a case you should provide a vest. I think everybody would agree not having a ballistic vest does create a substantial impact on safety. But at what threat level? At what bullet does it stop? We can't bargain that. Same question with tasers. Taser, having a taser or not having a taser is not a substantial impact on safety. Because taser is a device by which you subdue a suspect. It's not a device by which you protect yourself. So again, some of the equipment issues that make us safer in our ability to do the job don't meet the substantial impact test. And those are examples of why the current language doesn't work. I want to mention there was, in fact, George Berry testified, and George always had a saying, you get the union you deserve. And certainly, for instance, the city of Dallas has a wonderful relationship. When safety concerns are taken to their chief or their city, they fix them, and they fix them right away. This bill isn't designed for the city of Dallas. This bill is designed for those places where things get lost and they don't get fixed. And that's what happens is things get lost and they don't get fixed. And that's why we need this bill. I think I've just about, I couldn't let 750 go by. The comments about 750, I testified in those hearings. I still have marks from when the train ran me over. For if management truly wants to have a discussion, let's repeal 750. Let's go back to the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act of 73, and we'll sit down at the table, Adam. But at this point, they had their inning at bat. They did quite well. It's our turn to try and undo the damage. And that's what we're trying to do. And safety and staffing is one of those places. And with that, unless there are any questions.
Any? Representative Holby.
Thank you. Can you elaborate just a little bit? Is there another word besides potential in this bill that might be more palatable to the other side? And I caught your comments about substantial. Understand that, but
you know, quite frankly, if you deleted potential and just said safety, period, that would be fine. I think potential was proposed as an abundance of caution. Oh, I did want to mention on the Yamhill County Poppo case, we did arbitrate firearms. The county asserted throughout the process that it was a permissive subject. What happens if an arbitrator rules on a permissive subject? If the other side chooses to challenge it, it invalidates the arbitration decision. Because of the presentation at the case, the county commissioners there decided that they would not challenge the arbitrator's decision, so it was then implemented. But the county had asserted throughout that that was permissive. It went to arbitration because it was a single issue. They had settled wages and insurance, so it was a single issue arbitration. Would not have been taken to arbitration in accompaniment with wages and insurance.
Any more questions or comments? I just want to make a couple comments as far as the federal payments go. Let this federal government, if they don't continue them, they're letting people down. They're letting people down in those communities that voted for them, I might add. And there's no one in this building that's been more for logging more in this state than Mike Schaufler. And if we can find hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe $1 trillion, to waste over there on a boondoggle, and we're scrambling for money in this state, you know what, folks? You should find yourself in front of another committee that's 3,000 miles from here and give them hell. Anyway, on that, any more comments? Mr. Holby.
Representative Schaufler, Mr. Chairman, I think that maybe we should look into printing our own money, and you know, as has been suggested, maybe we can solve this.
All righty then. Thank you very much for your patience. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2404. Any more comments for the good of the order?
Have you decided and made a decision on what you were doing Thursday or Friday? You said...
Oh, you know what? That's the 23rd. You weren't
there. Oh, can we adjourn for some more?
And I call House Business and Labor Committee adjourned.
Adjourned.